This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Alan Turing made a proposal for the automatic computing engine, ACE, to the National Physical Laboratory, UK. The following is a comment and description of its storage system. Turing's design relied upon mercury-filled acoustic delay lines for high-speed storage, a technique developed for processing radar signals by comparing a series of echoes to things that had moved, and later applied to an early generation of computers. A series of electrical pulses, about a microsecond apart, were converted to a train of sound waves circulating in a long tube of mercury equipped with crystal transducers at both ends. About 1,000 digits could be stored in the microsecond it took a train of pulses to travel the length of a 5-foot tank. Viewed as part of a finite state Turing machine, the delay line represented a continuous loop of tape, 1,000 squares in length, and making 1,000 complete passes per second under the read-write head. Turing specified some 200 tubes, each storing 32 words of 32 bits for a total comparable with the memory capacity of a minnow of about 200,000 bits. The property of being digital, announced Turing to the London Mathematical Society in 1947 in a lecture on his design, should be of more interest than of being electronic. Whether memory took the form of paper tape, vacuum tube flip-flops, mercury pulse trains, or even papyrus scrolls, did not matter, as long as discrete symbols could be freely read, written, relocated, and, when so instructed, erased. The concept of random access memory and the resulting ability to store and manipulate both instructions and data in common is considered to have been the key invention in the development of electronic digital computers. Both these developments were implicit in the concept of a one-tape Turing machine introduced in 1936. It made no difference whether binary digits, instructions, data, or even temporary notes were stored as sound waves in a vibrating column of mercury or as symbols on paper tape. But the 5-channel tape readers of Colossus would have to be run at 1,200 miles per hour to keep up with a single mercury delay line stop.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Anthony, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very clearly, William.
Excellent. Good afternoon. So today's guest, where are you, in France?
I am, actually, yes. Yes, I am.
Okay, so we have a telephonic connection with the composer Anthony Moore. And a guest in the studio here is Ed Baxter, director of Resonance FM.
Hello,
104 FM, sorry.
Hello, William. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, Ed. Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. Lovely. I'm so glad you're there. I'm sorry I didn't write to you earlier. we should have been in touch in these intervening months, but there we are.
Yeah, been busy.
Well, we are here, gathered here today, to basically discuss your latest limited edition release, a double LP, gatefold sleeve, a double LP of essentially electronic and noise-based pieces, paired with astonishing text spoken by Anthony Moore. The concept is that objects of value, artifacts or minerals buried deep in the ground, send strange signals through the Earth up to the planet's surface. They are detected by the ears and instruments of miners, explorers, and archaeologists who are tuned in to the subterranean frequencies. The album contains a large booklet explaining this idea and featuring many pages of eccentric writing about sound. And that was your voice, I think, Anthony, that we heard at the beginning?
Yes, yes, yes. It sounded as if I was at death's door. There we go.
No, not at all. No, don't say that. No,
that's the way to sell the
exactly.
Shifter units, isn't it?
I hope
there
so.
There we are.
The double LP, but the double LP is a 45 RPM LP.
Oh yes. Wow. That's to impress more information in a shorter, onto the side of the LP. Yes.
Good right.
Stuff.
Okay.
Very
okay.
Pleased about that. Actually, not so common. But when I read up on it, at first I was a little bit confused myself and was concerned that, people played at the wrong speed and so on. But in fact, no, that's right. If you sort of read up on it, it's for some a chosen method of getting, optimum quality. And if you're not banging away with sort of lots of low bass and stuff like that, you can afford to do it and fit it onto a side of an LP.
Okay. Well, we should say that the LP is called Ore Torx. That's spelled O-R-E Torx.
Yes.
Am I correct? And that's because sound waves are sent through the earth or through rocks and so on.
Telluric signals.
Okay.
Well, yes, it's the ore talking. I mean, it is this notion of, well, it's a kind of reciprocal process, something I've always been interested in, really, which is the idea that perceiving and receiving and sending, to use sort of radio sending and receiving terms, are much more similar to each other than one might imagine. You know, it's the sort of idea of the answer on its way towards the question, the undiscovered, you know, making itself known before it's been discovered. And of course, it needs superluminality to work. But
there's a fairly hefty sort of manifesto comes with the record, a 20-page text. Presumably, it's necessary to read the text in order to comprehend.
No, not at all.
All right.
The text is just another entertainment, really. No, it's not an explanation. I don't think. What it is a collection of writings, which I put together sort of over the years, and with which I was sort of regaling my poor, confused students in a series of seminars and lectures at the Academy of Media Arts in Cologne, where I was working for quite a spell from 96 to 2016, just about. And in fact, the project itself, if I'm not jumping ahead, has been made possible by the Academy as a sort of, a gold watch, perhaps, as I was retired, you know, a couple of years ago. And it's a sort of a very nice gesture from them. They asked if it would be possible to put together such a collection of the writings, and of course accompanying these wonderful acoustic experiments from the Hörgruppe.
Right. Well, perhaps at this point we could whiz back to the beginning of your distinguished career, and Ed is going to help me out with this, because did you start with an outfit called Slap Happy?
Well, yes. I mean, that's not quite the beginning. It depends how far back you want to go, really.
Right.
Let's go back to the
Slap Happy Slap Happy is fairly early, and that was a sort of came out of a friendship with Peter Blegvad.
Right.
The inimitable Mr. Blegvad, and who I've known since we were sort of in our late teens, basically. And Dagmar Krauser, who I met in Hamburg, where I was, pursuing my career as an underground sound making sound for underground movies.
Yes, interesting. We were going to come to that. But Ed, do you have when did you first encounter Anthony?
Oh, about 3 minutes ago. No, I'm joking. don't know. I've known of Anthony's work since the Desperate Straits album was released,
yeah,
which must have been when I was about 14 or 15 or something of that age. And obviously for a long time until the Slap Happy concert at the ICA, where Peter, Dagmar and Anthony appeared in black roll neck sweaters and fish luminous fish heads, I think, wasn't it? or masks. It appeared like some three carp in a pot in a dark pond. Until then I hadn't set eyes on Anthony. So my first impression of him was as a small fish.
I see. Okay.
In a black pond. Yeah, but since then I put on a Slap Happy gig at Queen Elizabeth Hall, and Anthony very kindly invited me to give a presentation in Cologne. I think just before he was retired, as is I think legally required in Germany, very sensibly.
Yeah.
But Anthony, I think I'm right in saying in you're the your film soundtracks were done on analog tape. Is that the main medium you use?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's where it all really kicks off. I mean, the very late 60s, I find myself in a very lucky situation working with David Larcher on Mare's Tale in a big old rambling sort of place down in Kew, and we had a small budget from a benevolent producer, Alan Power, and we started buying up, or I started getting hold of old ferrographs and even the odd sort of cranky old Revox and stuff, and started working with tape, and that became an absolute passion. This extraordinary sense of holding in your hands a ribbon of time, interchangeably kind of addressed as sort of in terms of, you know, inches or in time. So unlike the digital realm, where you can't actually get hold of anything much, but and loops, of course, asynchronous, wild, long loops of noise sort of circling against each other and going in and out of phase, cutting, splicing. I remember tapes which had more splice. You couldn't actually see the back of the tape at all. It was just continuous splicing tape. And yes, that's right. It was all about tape. And sort of in my mind, I think it still is somehow.
Do you still have your tapes? Or have they been lost on?
Yeah, well, I mean, many of them have sort of fell apart after, well, what is it? It's 50, some of them would be, you know, over half a century old, and they would need to be baked and glued, you know, to get the ferrous oxide to sort of re-adhere to the plastic backing. And if you don't and you put it on the machine, it just sort of turns into powder before your eyes. It's kind of wonderful, but so a lot of it's gone, I should think, and a lot of it's dross as well, of course, but anyway, archiving is such a weird problem. Who knows what's important and what isn't?
And your current release, All Talks, kind of addresses that entire problematic, doesn't it? It made me think of one of my favourite lines from Friedrich Kittler's gramophone film Typewriter, is when he says that with the invention of sound recording, the epoch of nonsense, our epoch could begin. And he argues that recording makes trivia important and trivializes important things, and there's no way of telling in the moment what is important and what will last and what is merely being preserved. And I thought of that when I was reading your reference to Charles Babbage. And
well, of course, yes.
The air becomes one vast library on whose pages are forever written all that has been uttered, whether wise, worthless, or base.
Exactly. Everything by every idiot and every wise man alike is stored in the pages of the air. It's a beautiful, very nice thing. And I wonder if it's, you know, whether we really do have to accept that sound disappears completely, or whether we just don't have the instruments fine enough to retrieve it from the faint, you know, last faint shiverings of the molecules of the atmosphere. But Friedrich was a real he was a great friend, actually, and we spent some wonderful times together. And he wrote many, many wonderful things in that book, actually. Not least of which I come back to often is the Urgeräusch, the primal sound of. I don't know if that appears in the All Talks booklet, where Rilke speaks of wondering what it would be like to put the stylus of a record player into the cranial suture of a skull, which is what sound would it make? But anyway, yes, lovely man, Mr. Kittler, and sadly died a couple of years ago. But there we are.
The text ends with a kind of sort of an apocalyptic vision, but a universal vision at least, suggesting that the voice is waiting for a technical device to make sense of it. Again, you're quoting or misreading, as it were, Babbage. So there's a kind of science fiction element I found at the very end of the text, as though there might be an invention in the future that will recover even this telephone conversation at some point.
Right, exactly.
Copies of which will be destroyed at the end of the show.
Well, unfortunately, it's already in the vault, going directly into the vaults of the CIA as we speak, but where it'll last forever. But yes, actually, if I was a bit more professional, I suppose I would have had a copy of the booklet in front of me for this interview, and I haven't. But I can't remember exactly how it ends, but I hope it's not too culturally depressive, if you say apocalyptical. But there we are.
No, the very last line, in fact, is that one about Rilke.
So, well, now, is it? It is in there. Jolly
yes,
good.
That's well, in this a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah, there's a sort of thing about... I have a thing about collecting, you know, stuff from other people and sort of assembling it. And Zelinsky, Siegfried, who actually had an enormous influence on me, really, because he's a media archaeologist and, you know, researching the roots of the fax machine to sort of 17th century Hungary or something. That's probably not quite correct, but it became so interesting talking to him about the history of technical devices and so on. And he proposed that I write something about sound, and in the end we decided it's actually I'd be more interested in collecting other people's sort of ideas. And so, you know, the anecdotes and lifted out of various texts, some of them, I must admit, not primary sources, like the primal sound of the Ur sound of Rilke, and the Babbage stuff comes. Well, actually, you know, Charles Babbage, in Totnes in Devon, there's a little town museum, and they have a Charles Babbage room, and I have actually had a look at some of the Ninth Bridgewater treatise, which is where that comes from. But anyway, I'm rambling. What are we talking
rambling
about?
Rambling is good. your mention of the fax machine and Hungarians made
Zelinsky
me think of...
Zelinsky and media archaeology. Mm-hmm. Well, the history of technical devices, hugely interesting as far as I was concerned. I mean, partly obviously because I'm a bit ancient myself. I mean, soldering, which is where all talks text sort of kicks off, with the idea of soldering, Bakelite, hot valves in the dusty sort of back of amplifiers and things. It's all part of my, you know, it's all. So I can remember it from the 50s, just about, as a mad, you know, sort of 6, 7, 8-year-old kid trying to put mains electricity through a loudspeaker and such exciting projects. But it came back with Siegfried somehow, and he was a great inspiration with all his work. He's written lots of very nice texts and books, and he's collected, done really great symposia with wonderful people talking about the history of technical device, history of science, history of ideas. And I became very fascinated. So Or Talks, the project, exploring sort of the processing of signals through unlikely media and sort of abusing circuitry was very much part of that fascination with the sort of these ancient and touchable and feelable processes, as I say, somewhat unlike the digital.
Yeah, and there's a kind of elegiac shades of Dylan Thomas, even in your description of the lighting up of the street lamps in the village of the soul.
Oh my God.
They begin to glow like the valves in the back of a radio. I thought not only was it radiophonic, it was sort of, it brought to mind, maybe because I do know your age, because we met each other very recently. It brought to mind Under Milk Wood, of course.
And, oh, my God. I'd never made that connection. You know that bit of text that you're referring to?
Yeah.
Where does it even say something? Where is that? Anyway, wherever it is. That's from what's called a Festschrift, a celebratory book for a sort of German professor. And for Friedrich's 60th birthday, and they asked me to write something, and I think, you know, we'd been looking at Pynchon again and Gravity's Rainbow and all that stuff and talking, and so a lot of that sort of has kind of Pynchon-esque atmosphere to it, but I never thought of Dylan Thomas. That's quite an unusual idea, okay. That. Yeah.
Because in Pynchon's, is it the hard rain or the long rain or the something rain? What's that one? The small rain? I can't remember. One of his early short stories, The platoon all sit around playing Spot the Reference, which I think is the first time Spot the Reference is used in literature.
I don't know it, I have to admit. You've caught me out. I have no idea what you're referring to, but...
One of his very first stories is about a platoon rescuing dead bodies from a flooded river. It's kind of as Faulkner-esque as he gets, but of course the platoon are more like characters from the Phil Silvers show than from anything Faulkner would think of. But anyway, I suppose part of what you were saying earlier about receiving and transmitting is bound up in interpretation, and so I'm bringing my own projections into the booklet, and I was thinking, it made me think of things like Freud's insistence that song arises from paranoia, and that whistling in the dark forest is the musical action,
right.
And it also made me think of the kind of thresholds that John Cage and other modernist masters are forever trying to pinpoint, you know, between. You do write a lot about noise and silence. Somewhere nothingness is becoming somethingness.
Cage, of course, was kind of around in very. One of the reasons I took the job in Cologne was because of Stockhausen and Cage and people like that who went through the, you know, that amazing Klaus Schoening run WDR, Westdeutsche Rundfunk studio for acoustic concerts. I suddenly can't remember the English, he brought Cage, you know, very early in the 60s through that. And silence his writing is still very charming, Cage, I think, and I guess I read that ages and ages ago, and it probably stayed with me in one way or another. The thing about this, you know, sending and receiving and perceiving and hearing and so on, it arose for me on thinking about what could active perception mean. I mean, normally we tend to think of perception as reception, so that when you hear something, it's sound entering the ear, or seeing is stuff coming at you and hitting your senses, which are, one mistakenly imagines, are sort of in some sense passive. But the fact is that they're not. They're extremely active. And one of the phenomena that interested me because it's sort of, there's something perverse about it, if not inverse about it, are otoacoustic emissions, which are sounds that come out of the ear. And I immediately coined the phrase the transmitting ear, because it just struck me as being such a funny image somehow of sound emerging from this organ that seemed to be purely a collector of sounds. And I suddenly thought, well, that's interesting. I mean, the ear is sort of emitting sounds in order to receive sounds. So what happens when the sounds coming in opposite directions sort of meet each other? Are there standing waves? Is there phase cancellation? Is there, you know, what happens on what I started to call the ethereal skin of interference, as if outside our bodies was a kind of strange screen or skin or membrane where sort of emitted signals would meet incoming signals. And in fact, I started to think that what we imagine as being the world itself is no more than the sort of interference patterns of stuff hitting this membrane. And that became a very intriguing thing. I started to wonder how it was possible that the receiver could be sending and the sender somehow receiving, perhaps. And if the receiver is sending something in order to receive something, like the ore that sends its signals up to the discoverer on the surface, then there must have been some form of communication, which must have happened, as I say, faster than the superluminally and faster than the speed of light. And that, I wonder if it isn't altogether what our sixth sense is, some sort of Einstein-defying awareness of what's going on around us through some kind of...
Could I, Anthony, ask what...
Tell me to shut up.
No, not at all. No, I'm just curious about this idea of the ear generating sound.
Yes.
What is there evidence for this?
There is. I can chip in here, Anthony, because yes. I've been suffering from very severe tinnitus.
Join the club, mate.
I go into rooms and I actually have started to think that my ears are emitting this very loud, high-pitched noise, and that other people must be able to hear it. And of course, it's
a kind of an acoustic insanity. Fart. You mean?
Yeah. More than that, it's more like a siren that is emitting from my head.
Is your tinnitus fluctuating like a siren?
It's like a
feedback. Does it go up and down?
It's like a feedback solo by Toshimaru Nakamura. It's like a constant high-pitched whine, which I also think is psychosomatic.
It's not. And nor is it, as I think I might write somewhere, the engine of the is broken. But does that appear in the text, tinnitus thing?
The engine of what is broken?
Well, that some people consider it to be, you know, if you're driving in your car and you hear a strange sort of pinking sound, you think that there's something going in the engine. Similarly, of course, many tinnitus sufferers, in a sense, relate to their tinnitus as if it's the sound of the engine of themselves going awry. And,
yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah, I know. It's not. Do you know what it is? Friedrich Kittler himself found a very ancient fragment of Pythagoras in which he describes, basically, if when we hear tinnitus, what it is we're highly privileged because we're hearing the music of the spheres, Ed. So cheer up and enjoy it. I have it too. I mean, it's most definitely the loudest thing in my sonic universe, even in sort of, you know, roaring express trains and aeroplanes and everything, it still cuts through. A high-pitched, silvery whistle of something like a jet engine or something, the upper end of a jet engine noise.
Yeah, or and, an infinitely tiny kettle that's been left on the stove.
Yes, a
my God, what a put a fish in.
A thimble-sized kettle about to make a tiny cup of tea. Anyway, the thing about the high-pitched frequency, it sort of occupies a narrow bandwidth in a way. So if you imagine it as a kind of thin horizontal band of, you can begin to reflect that there's lots of space above and below it where things are relatively normal. What I have also, which is very nerve-wracking, is I have very low frequency tinnitus also, which basically sounds like somebody parked outside, you know, the bedroom window within a truck with the motor running. And that's not so pleasant because I get interference beats between reality and, I was about to call my tinnitus unreal. That's probably not correct. But the inner reality of the low-frequency tinnitus starts beating against the outer reality of the low-frequency noise of the world, which, especially in cities, of course, is relentless.
I look forward to the low one kicking in due course. That's terrifying.
Speaking of trucks, as you were, you sent me a very nice photograph of David Larcher's truck.
I did, didn't I? Yeah.
Which used to be parked outside the old London Filmmakers Co-op on Gloucester That's Avenue. Right. And I think in your description of the photograph, you describe it as a radio detecting truck.
Yes, it used to have an antenna. One of these sort of unpleasant-looking vehicles that sort of track you down if you haven't paid your TV license or something.
Hmm.
But I think that was the case, yes. I don't think the antenna was ever actually there, but the mounting for it was. And
it was a massive truck, wasn't it? I mean, it looked quite incongruous outside, you know, parked on a London road. It was sort of like a lorry, really, with a...
Well, it was a lorry.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a big Mercedes lorry with a longish snout.
Yes.
And as I mentioned to you prior to that, David the lorry man had a far larger one before, a huge silver Bedford Pantechnicon, which fell to pieces in Turkey and. There we are, when we were making Monkey's Birthday.
Doing the soundtrack then, did you actually accompany him on the on the films, as it were? You were filming with him creating the soundtrack at the same time?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yes, that was, you know, I mean, obviously these are non-narrative sort of kinds of films, and so it's not... I mean, I would say that it would be a nice idea if composers accompanied even, you know, narrative and Hollywood films and so on would make the sound probably somewhat more interesting than generally they are.
Right. Rather than being sort of slapped on afterwards, as it were.
Yes, exactly, with the last 1% of the budget to pay for it. You know?
Yeah. I told somebody, I contacted a friend of mine, and said that you were coming on this program and mentioned the David Larcher films, both of which are very long, aren't they? He tended to make sort of 3-hour-long films, I think.
I
got the following message back. You might know who this friend is. And he says, Anthony did the soundtrack for my 1971 film Focus, a lovely guy who shared a flat with Wyborny in Hamburg. Very helpful. I described what I wanted as to tone, duration, depth, etc. And he said he would gladly compose it and make it and sent me a mag track, which was perfect in block capitals, in the extreme, and is the soundtrack for the 10-minute Focus, a very German film, reflection of snow and pines outside a cold, hard, modern apartment. Do you remember who that was?
Weirdly enough, I think I can remember the images. I can't remember it now. It's not Rüdiger Neumann.
No.
Or certainly not Heinz Emmickholz. There was such a bunch of interesting German filmmakers. I lived in Hamburg for more or less 2 years as a kind of tape machine minstrel on the fringes of the underground movie scene.
Right. No, actually, it was Peter Gidal.
Peter Gidal?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, he was London-based, wasn't
yes.
he? And he was part of the filmmakers' co-op and so on. Yes, gosh, that's
indeed.
There's a name from the past.
Yes, and apparently you did the soundtrack for his film Focus.
Well, I'm very glad I did, and I'm even happier that he actually liked it, because...
He was delighted with it. He's
well, written... yes, that's great news, because most of the things I do are absolutely unlistenable, I find.
Well, don't say that. We want to try
well,
to,
God,
want to sell this record.
I've had to... Not the electroacoustic work. That's all fine.
Okay.
I'm talking about the film soundtracks.
Uh-huh.
I've sort of sat at festivals when these films have been screened. And not, by the way, the Larcher stuff, because I was very, I was very young. And David had a special talent of allowing all sorts of wonderful... rough and organic and error-strewn events to take place, and so those soundtracks are quite sort of rich and confusing and distorted and great. But a little bit later, when I became sort of quasi-sophisticated, I started producing one or two very difficult sort of minimalist soundtracks, and I've had to sit and watch them at festivals, and I've been so embarrassed. I've crept out the back of the room in the dark.
Oh.
But there we are. We all have to suffer somehow.
Okay. Well, back to the OR talks.
By the way, autoacoustic emissions is the answer to your question about evidence of sound coming out of the ear. OTO, as in cafe.
Right.
Acoustic, obviously, emissions. You can look it up.
Okay.
And
Thank you.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
Num, na? Has Ed sloped already?
No, he's here. He's thinking.
William's pulling up a fader.
Yeah, we've got your record. We've got the record playing in the background, so we
That's
sort of.
That's terrible! How dare you?
Oh, sorry.
Talk over my music.
Oh.
It's good. It's disguising various noises from my body.
Simultaneous reversibility.
Every time when I'm nervous, my stomach starts rumbling terribly. Not good for a broadcast, I tell you.
Well, this is your own text now, Anthony. This is you speaking here.
Yes. I think I should mix my own live voice with my recorded voice.
Well, exactly.
In some sort of unholy marriage. As you said, we are gathered here to marry Ed Baxter and Anthony Moore.
To illuminate that which seeks light.
That's quite uncomfortable to listen to, actually.
To what extent are you intervening in these sounds? I mean, are you just receiving the sounds from somewhere, or are you intervening in the production?
Oh, I have to tell you, of course, about the. But I'm one fifth of the group. You know, there
right.
are five of us working together, and because the voice so irritatingly assumes, and actually, to be honest, on that double album, thankfully, there's probably not more than, you know, 15% or 20% of the whole project in which my voice is really clearly hearable and understandable. The rest of the time, it has been processed heavily by being passed through strange ores and mercury and jumped across polystyrene resonators and all the rest of it. So fortunately, most of the record doesn't have my voice sitting on top of it. But with the voice sitting on top of it, one tends to mistakenly think it's somehow... that I'm any more important than any of the other guys, and I absolutely am not. There's Dirk Specht and Tobias Krawenig and Volker Hennes, and we just, had a wonderful time working on these self-built circuits, mostly constructed by the guys themselves. Very little pre-manufactured products in use. A lot of soldering, and masses of wires and cables everywhere. And a great sensibility for the power of noise as some kind of a music, I suppose.
And why is it the therapeutic listening group?
Well, the Therapeutische Hörgruppe Köln is their name, and they invited me as a sort of guest of honor, really, to join them for this project. I think that's a more fair way of looking at it than sort of. I'm getting a bit mixed up with some of my projects, because the other project is with the same personnel, more or less, is the Missing Present Band. You see, it does say Anthony Moore and the Therapeutische Hörgruppe Köln, doesn't it? I asked them not to do that, but they wouldn't. Or I wanted them to put the Hörgruppe with Anthony, you know, the other way around, but they didn't. But anyway, yeah, no, these are brilliant, brilliant Cologne-based electronic, you know, musicians who have done lots of great work, have a big body of work behind them, and continue to do very interesting pieces and facilitate possibilities for other upcoming, you know, electroacoustic composers to work and so on by curating festivals and putting on sort of sound exhibitions in and around Cologne. And they are really very, very cool guys. And Martin Ramori, of course, who I perhaps didn't mention, who's not actually Cologne-based, but is a wonderful musician and a great, great guy to know, as they all are. They're really good friends. I think I'm floating on their vibrations in this awkward phase of being recently retired.
You haven't just been recently retired, though, Anthony. You've been sort of reduced in the title of the work, haven't you? It's, of course, ORE is contained in your name, and the
You're M-O, not meant to have spotted that.
The M-O, the modus operandi, has
been obscured. Well, if you remember, one letter went out as well earlier in my career.
Yes, because the was it World Service you released as
Flying
A-O.
Flying doesn't help.
Yeah.
And World Service are all with 10 out of my family name. And then I decided to take the first letter out. The next one is going to be simply which I think is sort of OE. Isn't that like an O umlaut? OE?
Yeah. I should. Okay, I'm just going to recap that you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is Anthony Moore. Whereabouts are you, Anthony, exactly?
I'm just. Do I want to tell you?
Not necessarily.
I'm down south in not far from Marseille.
Okay. And here in the studio, we've been talking with Ed Baxter, director of Resonance, and we've been playing and discussing the record Or Talks, a double LP, only a few copies available. It comes in a gatefold sleeve with a 20-page booklet, four sides of vinyl. Where is it available?
Our Music in Cologne, A-MUSIK.
Right.
A great record, a really brilliant record store and label, in the heart of Cologne, and they're holding on to, you know, all the bits and pieces, few spare copies we could keep, And I think that there are a few. I mean, you know, 100 or something, possibly.
Wow. Okay.
And they can, that's, and Discogs, you know, and the usual culprits, I think.
Right.
But basically, our music in okay. Cologne.
Right. So anyone wanting it should look up the title is Ore Talks, O-R-E Talks.
Yes, I think I haven't sort of searched for it myself particularly, but I hope it comes up. Hmm. But, you know, if anybody's interested, really, they should go to Arm Music, a-music.com/. And it's a Cologne record shop, and they will have a great time there because there's masses of interesting stuff that they produce and retail.
So, Anthony, I saw you performing with Slap Happy in London in, I think, February it was now. It doesn't seem that long ago.
Yeah, Cafe Oto.
Yeah, what's next on the horizon for you? Now you're retired.
I'm going to Japan in about 4 days.
Yeah, to do another Slap Happy tour?
No, oh. I'm doing a solo thing. A weird sort of combination of installation talk and melancholic sort of chanson.
We each have our cross to bear.
Yes. Not to mention the poor people who have to listen to it.
Are these self-composed chansons?
Yes, yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Right. They are. And some of them are reworkings of the old classics from the back catalogue. Like, ouch, ow, I just stubbed my toe. I'm pacing up and down nervously.
Is that the title of the song? That sounds like a melancholic song, isn't it?
Yes. Ow.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
No,
sorry to hear that.
Yes, it's all terribly, terribly exciting. And I mean, I have to say, I think Jan Lankish and the Weekend Festival in Cologne sort of kicked it off a couple of years ago. Well, no, that's not true. Dirk Specht, who's one of the Therapeutische Hörgruppe, who's part of Raya M, which is a great collection of music-minded organizational and, you know, curatorial and people in Cologne invited me to do something at the Stadtgarten, and that was in November 2016. That was really pretty soon after I'd finished teaching. And I think before that, I hadn't got up on a sort of musical stage to do a performance for absolutely decades. And it was such a pleasure to do it, and then after that we did some. That was the Missing Present band, and the gig got recorded, so a live album came out also on A Music called The Present Is Missing, and especially released for Christmas time, but don't quite know if it really made any difference. And nobody's laughing at my silly joke.
That's because I thought of it earlier myself.
Yeah. There was just a sort of terrible radio silence.
Oh, no.
I felt very...
Sorry, we only laugh very, when you injure depressed. Yourself, Anthony. You have to stub the other toe. I got a great laugh.
Anyway,
You said yeah, chanson. No. Are these in English or French?
English.
Or Japanese? English.
English. English. No, I was just sort of tracking back through why, strangely, I've become so active and busy on performing, which is wonderful and something I really never did too much of, even in the Slap Happy days and even in the early, you know, Virgin days with around Desperate Straits and Henry Cow and all that stuff in the 70s. I was shy. I was a sort of studio animal. I loved nothing better than to crawl around under a mixing desk with sort of cables in my teeth. And but anyway, it's great. Yes, and I haven't sort of looked back. I did a wonderful festival called Mia Kuzma in Belgium, where I had the lovely encounters with Philip Jeck and David Toop and all sorts of marvellous people popped up. And then Rio, which is, you know, rock in opposition here in France. And off to Japan in a couple of days. So busy, busy.
Okay, well, bon voyage there, Anthony. You must bear in mind you still owe me a radiophonic project you're going to do when you're less busy.
I know. It's never gone away. It sits there haunting me as an undone project. You know, and I will try to come up with something. I must. I want to. How are you, Ed? Are you okay? Everything all right over there?
I am, but I don't think that's legitimate.
Apart from the tinnitus, of
legitimate
course.
Content for a radio broadcaster, isn't it? My health. We talked about my tinnitus. That's the main object of fascination in my life at the moment. Well, I'll drop you a line soon, Anthony.
Yeah. I hope we get together soon.
That'd be good.
I very much enjoy that. And William, thank you. This feels like an ending. Am I right?
We are indeed fast approaching the end of the programme. Thank you very much to Anthony Moore for joining us on the telephone from somewhere near Marseille, and Ed Baxter here in the studio. And we'll play out with a bit more of Ore Talks. Thank you very much, Anthony. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye. Thanks, William. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.